From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. We live in a throwaway world. Tons of packaging, plastic bags, laptops, cell phones, and water bottles get tossed out every day in staggering numbers. But today there's a new movement that's taking a bite out of the world's waste. It's called upcycling. Recycling breaks stuff down into its raw components, but upcycling uses discarded materials, just as they are, to make something new, from a coin pouch to a musical instrument. This hour, the upcycling movement, and why recycling doesn't always work.
Rather than recycling these bottles, what's actually happening is that we're removing and delaying the disposal of them. Rather than a plastic bottle being thrown away here in California, a plastic flip-flop is thrown away in China 3 months later. That is not what diligent recyclers rinsing out their bottles have in mind when they think about recycling these plastic bottles.
Also, the do-it-yourselfer's guide to life in the upcycling lane.
Garbage is one of those things that we really don't like to hang out around. I think people don't like thinking about waste and that sort of topic, and because of that, people don't get into it. It's not a sexy business.
And legendary filmmaker Bruce Conner's found film leads the way.
The whole early history of music video is basically one gigantic ripoff of Bruce Conner's ideas.
If you ever wondered what really happens to the things we throw away and recycle, the answer probably isn't what you think. Annie Leonard has devoted her life to tracking our stuff, from the raw materials to the design, consumption, and ultimate disposal of all the goods we consume every day. Steve Paulson sat down with her and talked about her book, The Story of Stuff.
Let's start at the landfill, because that's where so much of our stuff ends up. You say that your eyes were really opened when you were a college student in New York City and you visited the Fresh Kills landfill on Staten Island. What did you see there?
Oh, I saw the hidden life of all of the stuff that we have in our homes and our workplaces and our every place. I saw the final resting place of our pizza boxes, our shoes, our iPods, our everything you can imagine. It was such a profound experience that I now actually go to a landfill about once a year, and I really recommend it to everyone. I think it should be required before we get our first credit card.
Well, and just to talk about this particular landfill, Fresh Kills, it was huge. I mean, 4.5 square miles of trash?
Is absolutely huge. I stood there as a sophomore in college and looked out, and in every direction, literally as far as I could see, was waste. You know, furniture, appliances, shoes, food, books. It was just absolutely stunning. I was stunned at both the scale of it, and I was also stunned at the hiddenness of it, the secrecy of it. How could I have gone all the way to being a sophomore in college without ever realizing that our society created that much waste?
But you say most of the trash in a landfill is actually paper.
Well, right now about 40% of our trash in the United States is paper, which I think is a stunning statistic because, you know, recycling has been a household word now for decades, and we could cut our garbage production by 40% just by reducing and recycling our paper. So about 40% is paper. There's a huge amount that's organic waste, food waste, yard waste. There's a lot of metals, a lot of things that can be recycled. It's absolutely easy to get rid of about 80% of that stuff. The rest are things like DVD players and iPods and things where the real problem is not about recycling, but the real problem is at the design stage. At the design stage, about 80% of a product's impact is determined. If those companies made them safer, less toxic, more durable, maybe modular so you could take out the broken part and replace it, then they wouldn't end up in the landfill at all.
Is that intentional, do you think, that some of those products are not easily broken down so parts can be replaced?
I believe it's very intentional. It's all part of a strategy that's called planned obsolescence, or in layman's term, designed for the dump. Our products, especially our electronic gizmos these days, they simply don't last. I don't know about you, but I grew up with one toaster and one kitchen clock and, you know, one couch and one everything, and it lasted our whole lives. But these days, you're lucky to get a year out of these things. The average cell phone life in this country now is about a year, and they're hard to recycle because they have all different kinds of plastics and toxic metals. They're hard to repair. A lot of these electronic gizmos don't even have a screw, so you can't even open them if you want to see what's broken inside. They're not modular, so it's hard to, you know, take out and replace the broken part. They're designed to be not recyclable in the first place. So our demand to those companies are make them safe, make them last.
Well, what you did is you followed quite literally the paper trail of where all this stuff comes from. What did you find?
Well, I followed it all over the world. I've visited hundreds of factories where our stuff is made and dumps where our stuff is dumped. And what I found is that we have, in the United States, succeeded at exporting the bulk of the environmental and health damage of our products, both when they're made and when they're disposed, so that we can have their continued consumption here in the United States. So increasingly, the factories that make our stuff, which produce waste and expose workers to all kinds of environmental health and occupational safety issues, the factories are relocated overseas. They ship the stuff here. We use it literally sometimes just for a few minutes, like a plastic bag or a plastic water bottle, and then we export the waste back overseas. So we've succeeded in externalizing or exporting the dangers of production and disposal, rather than come to terms with the real impact of our consumption habits here in the United States.
What do you mean we export the waste back overseas? You're saying we're actually literally shipping garbage overseas?
Absolutely. We're shipping all kinds of waste overseas. One of the cases that I explored that I thought was really fascinating was what is happening to all of those plastic bottles that people diligently rinse out and put in their blue bins for recycling and feel so good about. And so I decided to track it. There's a database called PIRS that stands for Port Import Export Research Service, and it lists all of the shipments of everything coming into and out of the U.S. So I studied that for a number of months and saw that there were huge amounts, like millions and millions of pounds of plastic waste being exported to Asia, to Indonesia, to Philippines, to China, to India. So I followed it to see what was there. In one instance, I was in southern India, right outside Madras. It's now called Chennai, and I was tracking where all this plastic was going, because the port data said it was going to Chennai. And I asked the rag pickers, the scavengers, the people who are really the bottom of the economic ladder in a lot of these countries who make a living by collecting garbage in the streets. They always know where the imported waste is going, because that is undercutting their ability to sell the locally collected garbage. So they pointed me to a factory, and I will never forget riding a little rickshaw over this hill in southern India and seeing a mound of plastic soda bottles from recycling programs in the United States. I saw the same thing in China, in Indonesia, in the Philippines, all over. Another waste stream that we export that's particularly hazardous right now is our e-waste stream. All of our electronic gadgets are loaded with all kinds of toxic heavy metals, lead, cadmium, mercury, flame retardants, things like this. So much that recycling electronics, you know, broken computers, cell phones, is potentially valuable because there's a little bit of gold and copper and valuable metals in each one of these things, but also very hazardous because of these hazardous components. So if one does want to recycle those things here, which is technically challenging anyway because of bad design decisions, it's very intensive to do so. So a lot of companies are collecting up this e-waste and then shipping them overseas to Africa and to Asia, where people with no environmental health protection at all, no regulations, break these things open and recover the minute amounts of valuable stuff and then just chuck or burn the rest.
Yeah, but getting back to the plastic water bottles, why are those being shipped overseas? Why, I mean, these can be recycled. Why aren't they recycled in this country if we consume them here?
Well, there's a couple issues. One is that they can't actually be recycled. They can be reprocessed, or what some people call downcycled. With true recycling, you want to create a closed loop. So if you made a piece of paper into a piece of paper into a piece of paper, or a glass bottle into a glass bottle into a glass bottle, then you've succeeded at reducing the natural resource input and reducing the waste output. That would be a closed loop successful recycling. With plastic, each time that you heat the plastic, the polymer chains degrade so that you end up with a lower quality plastic. So right now, the technology is not available to make 100% recycled PET bottle out of 100% recycled PET bottle indefinitely. You can't have true recycling. You have downcycling, where the plastic bottles are turned into a secondary item, which is of lower quality.
So to follow up on the other example that you used about electronics, take me through the trail of, let's say, a laptop computer, sort of how it's made, where that material comes from, and then what eventually happens to it.
Well, laptop computers are a particularly interesting example for a couple reasons. One is how incredibly complex the supply chain is. The supply chain refers to all the places that contribute materials or, you know, have handle this computer at some point during its production. Laptop computers can have materials from 1,000 different places, from mines in Africa, from chemical factories in Gujarat or Malaysia. I mean, literally from all over the planet. So you have a very well-traveled set of components by the time you actually buy the laptop. We then use them for a year or two until they break. I mean, my current one is a year old and is already causing me all these problems. So when you want to get rid of it, there are very few options. In many places now, the land disposal of these things is prohibited because of all the toxic chemicals in them. So you send them to a recycler. Unfortunately, the bulk of recyclers that we've found in the United States are exporting these things to developing countries. And there have been some fabulous exposés. One organization that's done a lot of work on this is the Basel Action Network. Their website is ban.org. And you can see some wonderful images. I mean, wonderful, horrifying images of where these things end up. Increasingly, these e-waste that we send for recycling is sent to Africa or to Asia, where literally whole families sit around with a hammer, very medieval-style processing, just smash the stuff open, pull out the little bits of valuable material, and then chuck the rest. One of the practices that's really concerning is the reclamation of the copper wire. Copper has some resale value, so they want to pull out the copper wire. But it's usually coated in PVC coating. And so they need to get that PVC coating off to access the copper. So one common practice is to just put all these PVC coated copper wires in a pile, light it on fire, and burn the PVC, which is an enormous source of dioxin. So this is a really serious environmental health threat for these e-waste recyclers. There is a way to avoid this, which is to take your used laptop. First of all, use it as long as possible and resist all those incessant Mac ads telling you to upgrade. But when it finally is at the end of its life cycle, take it to an e-waste recycler that is certified as an e-steward recycler. This is a neutral third-party certification system where they guarantee that the e-waste will not be exported to third-world countries.
Well, it's interesting to hear that example because one way to interpret what you're saying is, well, the problem is capitalism. I mean, it's just, you know, lots of companies, big companies, make lots of stuff. That's how they make their profits. They don't really care that much about what happens to it. I mean, obviously, that's not the case across the board. There are some environmentally conscious CEOs out there. How much is capitalism the problem?
That's funny. You've mentioned the C word that we're prohibited from discussing in this country. I find it so interesting how the story of stuff was attacked so much for being anti-capitalist. Glenn Beck talked about it every day for a week. And when I made the story of stuff, I wasn't setting out to critique capitalism. I was setting out to describe what I had seen in 20 years of looking at factories and dumps. And when I started getting attacked as anti-capitalist, it made me think a little deeper and go dust off my old economic textbooks. And it turns out that those critics are right, that there are some really core aspects of capitalism that are leading to environmental destruction. One of those core aspects is an absolute fixation on never-ending growth. If our business sector's goal is just growing, 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 it's going to have to come at the expense of something which is too often the planet. We could have a different kind of economic dominant paradigm where we said that we want a thriving, healthy economy, but not at the expense of the biological systems on which life depends. It's absolutely possible, but under our current dominant economic system, which is capitalism, I don't see how we're going to be able to bring about the level of change we needed to be able to reach ecological and social well-being.
So who would you say is ultimately responsible for trashing the planet? Is it corporations without a conscience, governments that don't do anything to try to regulate what's going on, or is it us who really don't think that much about what we buy and what we throw out?
I think we all have a part in the problem and we all have a part in the solution, but our parts are not equal. I'm critical of these focuses on individual lifestyle changes and, you know, it's our fault that there's global warming because we didn't ride our bike or we didn't recycle or we didn't carry our own bag to the store. Of course, I think we should do all those things and we should definitely strive to live as low impact as possible, but we're operating within a system where the current is moving us towards greater ecological devastation. So these individual actions that we can do, it's kind of like getting better and better at swimming upstream when the current is still going towards environmental destruction. We need to really focus our attention on changing the direction of the current rather than nagging our friends to take public transportation, even if it takes four times as long and costs, you know, five times as much money. Let's work together to get better public transportation so that the ecologically preferable option is the new default. We need to make doing the right thing as easy as falling off a log. And right now it's not. So you can't really blame individuals when often the best choice is just simply not available.
Annie Leonard is the author of The Story of Stuff. She spoke with Steve Paulson. To hear an extended interview with Leonard or watch her 2007 video that sparked an internet sensation, visit our website, ttbook.org. Coming up, the upcycling movement finds a home with do-it-yourselfers. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin Online Bachelor of Science in Sustainable Management, developing leaders with the critical skills to grow a green economy. Information is at sustain.wisconsin.edu.
So what can you do with garbage? For Tom Zaki, the question is, what can't you do with garbage? His company, TerraCycle, turns waste, like Skittles candy wrappers and Capri Sun juice pouches, into backpacks and pencil cases. And he's taken these green products into stores like Walmart and Home Depot. In his book, Revolution in a Bottle, How TerraCycle is Redefining Green Business, Zaki has a lot of ideas about what to do with garbage.
Well, there's three things you can do with garbage, or maybe even four. One is you can send it to a landfill. One is you can incinerate it. Europe does actually, half of all European garbage is burned, which is a little scary. And then the next thing you can do is recycle, where you melt it and you recover the polymer. And then the fourth, which is the very best, is upcycling, where you value every aspect of the waste. Take a chip bag. Upcycling a chip bag, you know, you could fold it and make it into a bracelet, weave it. You can make it into a fabric and sew it so that the logos are still present. That would be upcycling. Recycling would be melting the chip bag into a plastic and then making that into like a plastic cup or something of that sort. So the distinction is in recycling, you're only valuing the polymer. In upcycling, you're valuing every aspect of the waste, the shape, the color, and the polymer.
Then you get to the next step, which is, how does it work? Where do you get the waste? And what do you do with it when you get it?
Absolutely. So the way our business works is we first actually start with waste. It's not driven by you know, we want a product and then, hey, let's figure out what type of garbage we want to make it from. It's we want to create a collection program at the scale of recycling for all relevant waste streams. So let's take an example. Take pens. So we'll go to the world's biggest pen companies, Bic and Sanford, and they fund us to create national collection programs where basically you can go to our website, terracycle.net, and sign up for the pen collection program. That's one of 28 programs we have right now. And then you just take a cardboard box, you fill it up with any brand of pen, but a significant amount of pens. And then once the box is filled, you download a free UPS shipping label from our website and send it in. So the shipping is free. And then when we receive it, we make a donation of 2 cents for every piece of garbage you sent to us. So it's a way to raise money. Now, once your account is credited that money, you have to allocate it to any charity or any school in America. And then TerraCycle will pay those organizations directly. And that just repeats and repeats and repeats. And today we have over 10 million people in America sending us close to 10 to 20 million pieces of garbage a week. So it's become quite robust in scale.
So you're saying you start without the idea of what you're going to do with the waste. You look at a source for waste and the ability to collect it, and then go on to think what you're going to do?
Yeah, it's sort of reversed, you know, because usually you would think, okay, I want to make a product, and what are the right raw materials for that product? And then you go find the raw materials, whether they happen to be garbage or new raw materials. For us, we haven't found a waste stream that can't be solved. Every type of garbage we've ever been presented, everything from expired pills and pill packaging to food packaging to, you know, all sorts of different things, we have found solutions for. So what we're out there doing is trying to find companies, big brands, that are willing to finance these programs. So to give an example, I mean, these, you know, don't come cheap. Capri Sun, which is one of our largest programs, they fund the juice pouch collection program. Now, we get in close to 2 million juice pouches a week, and that just the 2-cent donation on that is around $40,000 a week that the brand has to cover in the end. And so we're looking for major companies that are willing to take responsibility for their waste by funding programs like this. And what's amazing is that there's a huge number of companies out there willing to do that. And so that's why we're always driven by waste first. And then once we know what waste is coming in, then, you know, our obligation is to figure out what we can do with it, because if not, we'd be basically a landfill inventorying lots of garbage.
Sounds like a pretty good deal. You get the company to pay, you get people to do the collection, and then you're left with a product that you can use however you want.
The idea here is, you know, trying to make a win-win-win where the consumer wins because you don't have to throw something out, which is typically a negative thing, and you can raise money, and it's pretty easy, basically as easy as recycling. The brands win because they move one of their, you know, a product that is totally non-recyclable. If a brand makes, let's say, Frito-Lay, if they make 1 billion chip bags a year, that means 1 billion chip bags end up in a landfill every year, at least before TerraCycle. Now there's a solution that's as easy as recycling, and that's a very big win for them. And then we win because we get free raw materials, and then we can make products that are super eco-friendly, made from garbage, and are not in any way premium price because our raw materials are garbage and relatively free.
You started, I understand, with something you called worm poop when you were still in school. Is that right? What was worm poop?
Well, worm poop, quite literally, is worm poop. But basically, what the real unique, this is how TerraCycle came to be. This was the inspiration. I'm originally from Canada and then moved down, went to Princeton for undergrad. And to be honest, my friends in Toronto, where we were living, we were all growing pot in our basement at the time. Canada's a little more relaxed with this sort of thing than down here. And the plants weren't really doing all that well. It's not an easy vocation. And so the plants ended up moving to Montreal because my friends, some of them got into school in McGill, and I came down to New Jersey, and it wasn't the best idea to bring them here. And they had a really hard time with them. And finally, the miracle was feeding the plants worm poop, which is organic waste fed to red worms, and the worms poop out worm poop. It's actually a very common thing that, you know, gardeners have done for hundreds of years, but that made the plants grow incredibly well. So I end up in Montreal my fall break freshman year and get obviously very inspired by, you know, how amazing worm poop is. And TerraCycle as a business started there. I ended up dropping out of school within 6 months, and TerraCycle was a worm poop company. We actually took liquid worm poop and packaged it in used soda bottles. As an ironic side note, we're the only company in the world to first reuse soda bottles for packaging, not melt them, but just refill them. And we're also the only company in the world to have licenses from both Coca-Cola and PepsiCo for packaging feces in their distinctive shape, which is, I think is a pretty cool goes to show you, right? And that's how it all began. You know, for the first 4 years of our business, we're 8 years old now, but for the first 4 years, it was all worm poop. We kept growing. Our sales kept growing very fast. And then we got challenged by actually the first two companies to join us was Clif Bar out of California, and then Honest Tea and Stonyfield. These are all eco brands, great American brands, and they all had something in common. Clif Bar had energy bar wrappers. Stonyfield Yogurt had yogurt tubs. Honest Tea had juice pouches, all three of these materials being non-recyclable. And so they said, hey, you guys have been really good about making products from waste. Can you solve these waste streams? And we did that. And then we invented the collection program, the Brigades. And from there, it just blew up around the world. It's been phenomenal.
You have to start with a company that cares about this, though, right? Because you're looking at pens that can go into the landfill. What does the company care about that? I mean, a PR problem, but they don't have to deal with it, do they?
No, you're right. Now, if you look at it from a global perspective, we're now in 8 countries around the world. I can tell you, going around the world, seeing everyone's recycling infrastructure, America is basically in the middle. We're sort of a B+, if you will, from a global recycling perspective. If you look at other countries, say even our neighbors, Canada, or you know, in Europe, or even in Brazil, they're just passing or have passed packaging taxes where all companies are responsible to pay for their packaging and pay for that end-of-life problem. And these companies, these global multinationals, are really seeing this all over the world and want to solve for it in the places the taxes exist. But also, they're looking at it in the U.S. as a way to proactively solve for it. Because the big issue with packaging taxes, at least for these major companies, is that they have to pay for every piece of garbage produced. With TerraCycle, they pay for every piece of garbage collected, which is a very different way to look at that. And they see a very big win in solving for a problem that is so obvious, like their packaging.
So how green is this, really? I mean, what do you have to do with the waste you collect in order to upcycle it?
The way our model works is that the garbage comes in, and then it typically has to be cleaned. So there's a little cleaning process. It's all using, you know, eco-friendly materials. It's really not all that challenging for the environment. And then we look at how can we manipulate these waste streams. So as an example, take a Frito-Lay chip bag. One way to manipulate it is we can laminate multiple bags together and create a branded fabric, if you will. Basically looks like a chip bag but can hold a stitch. The second is we can shred and compress it into a board. Now, what's interesting, a lot of these waste streams already have intrinsic capabilities. So a chip bag already has a thin layer of glue on the inside and the outside, which means when you shred and compress it, you don't have to add any new materials like a glue or some sort of adhesive. The third manipulation is we can pelletize it into a plastic, and that can be injection molded and or thermoformed or any type of plastic process. And then the fourth manipulation is that we can actually make it into a textile. What happens from here is we then actually go to best-in-class manufacturing partners who then, you know, take the biggest backpack company in America. They then acquire the waste from us, and they're the ones who produce the backpack and sell it into Walmart under or Target or whatever major retailer under the TerraCycle brand. And in each of these cases, what we're doing is taking existing companies who have major products and major retailers and having them move away from using virgin materials and instead use garbage as the input for their product. And that allows us to get to very big scale quickly and have very big environmental impact in a very short period of time. If you look at it from a carbon perspective, upcycling is typically 80% less carbon than the normal version of that same product. So a Capri Sun pencil case is 80% less carbon than a normal cotton pencil case. In plastics, if you take a chip bag and make it into a plastic polymer, you're typically seeing, say, 30 to 60% carbon savings. So either way, these are pretty substantial numbers, especially when you take them and multiply them on very big scales.
And, you know, I've read about recycled products that they can often only be recycled once, maybe twice. After that, there's literally, they say, nothing they can do with them anymore. Is that true for upcycled process as well?
Yes. Every time you take a material through a cycle, it will degrade. Plastics typically can get 5 or 10 cycles on them. There are some that have very few. But even in upcycling, so let's say you go and you have a product that we make that is upcycled, say that Capri Sun pencil case. At some point in time, that pencil case will die as well, and you won't want it anymore. You can put it back in our collection. We actually will ship it back to ourselves for free. And then we also give a donation again on the product. So if the pencil case is made from 6 pouches, you get a 12-cent donation as a way to encourage people sending the products back. But that pencil case will never be upcycled again. It'll then go into a recycling solution where we can granulize it and turn it into something like a plastic lumber. Now, if we get that plastic lumber back, then that can go into another piece of plastic lumber as long as we add in some what we call first cycle material so that you never get into that degradation problem that you were mentioning earlier.
Yeah. So you're not just deferring the eventual trip to the dump. You've really thought this through, and it's each time recycled or upcycled or redirected.
Yes. Now, with the one quid pro quo that the consumer has to participate or it doesn't work. If you go buy, you know, one of TerraCycle's products, it's your choice whether you send it to us. We make the system available. We make it free. But if you don't send it back and you put it in the landfill, that's something we cannot do anything about. So we really rely on the consumer to do the work, really, participating in this model.
In your book, you talk about something you call waste in nature. I guess that's pretty obvious. Do you compare what you do with what nature does in dealing with waste?
We try to copy what nature does. I think nature has solved for perfectly. You know, in nature, garbage doesn't exist. The output of one system is not just a negative or a neutral, it's an entire positive to another system. Think of any natural system, and that's the case. In our system, it's a great irony because we have tremendous amount of output. We use things typically once and throw them out, and that output is treated as a negative. We actually pay to get rid of it. That's basically the definition of garbage, and it's just not natural, literally. And so what we try to do is emulate what nature has done and get as close to that as possible. I don't think we'll ever be as perfect as nature because we always are going to have to add energy and add new things to create conversions. But either way, the closer we can get to nature, the closer we can get to eliminating the entire concept of garbage.
TerraCycle plans to collect over 70 million Capri Sun pouches this year to make into things like pencil cases, lunch boxes, and messenger bags. Tom Zaki is founder and CEO of TerraCycle and author of Revolution in a Bottle, How TerraCycle is Redefining Green Business. Mark Frauenfelder has a passion for making things, and he's done more than his share to create a community of DIYers and what he calls makers. He's the co-creator of the weblog boingboing.net and the editor-in-chief of Make Magazine. Recently, Frauenfelder wrote a book about his passion for do-it-yourself projects called Made by Hand, Searching for Meaning in a Throwaway World. He told Ann Strainchamps that making things brings huge satisfaction.
Making things that I use every day or have, you know, some kind of effect on my life every day makes me feel that I have kind of a sense of control and I feel more fulfilled about my daily life. Raising my own chickens and becoming a beekeeper and practicing old school food preservation methods, those kind of food related activities are something that, you know, affects me and my family every day. And having that kind of sense of control of being able to have a hand in my food, so to speak, is a really powerful feeling of fulfillment that you get from that.
Now, some of this almost sounds like turning the clock back. You know, when I think about people who build their own skateboards or figure out how to take apart small appliances and turn them into other, even cooler small appliances, I think about the past, you know, about the 40s and 50s and 60s and home hobbyists who read magazines like Popular Mechanics. Why do you think this is coming back now?
Well, I think, you know, in the past, a big reason that people did that kind of stuff was because it did save money. In the 50s, color television set cost an equivalent of about $8,000 in today's money adjusted for inflation. Today, you can buy a color television, you know, the same screen size for, you know, $150. In those days, if your TV broke, you couldn't throw it away and buy a new one. It was just unaffordable. So the manufacturers knew that you could take the back off the television and pull the tubes out, take the tubes down to the local drugstore and plug them into a machine that would let you know if the tubes needed replacing or not. And so people were kind of makers and tinkerers by necessity, but they also, because they had acquired these skills and weren't fearful of technology or doing things with their hands, they also wanted to, you know, branch that out into more hobbyist-based activities. And that's why you saw magazines like Popular Science and Radio and Electronics, where people would do things like take an old lawnmower and turn it into a go-kart or convert the basement into a little leisure area for the family.
But, you know, I think it's not just that our grandparents and parents were better at making things. It's also that manufacturers today actively discourage people from tinkering with their appliances. I mean, you know, their entire website's about how to hack your iPod because Apple doesn't want you to.
Well, there are a couple of reasons. You know, one is that manufacturing methods use things like glue instead of, you know, screws and things to put things together. So these things are kind of hermetically sealed. They're really hard to get to. And you have, you know, new kinds of technologies. So the electronic components are very tiny surface mounted things that are hard to swap in and out and change. So that's one reason why it's harder to hack stuff now than older stuff. But the other reason, like you mentioned with Apple, is that they have deals with the entertainment companies for digital rights management, where they don't want to give people access to being able to, you know, swap songs or movies or convert them from one device to another and things like that. So that's another, you know, that's another challenge for DIYers to address. In a way, it's fun for them to kind of go around these barriers that have been set up for them.
So what about some of the pioneers in this movement? You describe a number of them in the book. Who are some of the people you call the alpha makers?
Oh, yeah, there are quite a few people that, you know, I've met through Make Magazine who really stand out. There's a fellow named Bree Pettis, who is the co-inventor of a machine called the MakerBot. It's a 3D printer, and you can design a, you know, a part, a component, like a bottle opener or a toy or a comb or something like that, anything that could be made out of plastic. And this thing will print it out layer by layer, and you can see a little 3D part being made. It almost looks like the nozzle of a hot glue gun, except the plastic that comes out is exactly the same kind of plastic that Lego bricks are made of.
That makes me think of it. Do you remember those horrible little oven toys that we used to have, and you squirted the plastic gel into them, and then you could mold it into, I don't know, insects or other creepy crawlers.
Yeah,
things.
Yeah, the creepy crawlers, and it was called the Thing Maker. Was that device?
That was it.
Yeah,
this is like a grown-up version of the Thing Maker.
It is totally, but you know, with the old Thing Maker, you were stuck using the molds that the manufacturer gave you. But in this case, you can make anything that you can design on your computer. So, you know, Bree's one of the alpha makers. You know, there are so many others. Another is a woman named Lamour Freed, who started a kit business selling electronic kits that she has designed herself. One of them is a thing she calls a Minty Boost, and it's a iPhone or iPod charger that's housed in an Altoids tin. And if your iPhone starts to run low on batteries, if you have one of these in your backpack or pocket, you can just stick it into your iPhone and you're back in business. She is running now, you know, a really successful business based on her own DIY endeavors and encouraging other people to learn about DIY through kits. Hmm. There are so many people. There's Mr. Jalopy, a friend of mine, who builds what I call functional art projects. He took an old stereo cabinet from the 40s and added a Macintosh computer to it so that when you play an LP, the LP is converted to an MP3 and added to the computer so that every time he goes to garage sales and just buys records, tons of records, and it just plays the record and then it's stored forever on the hard drive. And the cabinet from the outside, you could never tell that it had been modified in this way. But, you know, this is something that he wanted. He didn't see a good solution out there. And so he, you know, said, I'm going to build this for myself. And that's what he did. And he does that kind of stuff all the time.
So how did this play out in your own life? I mean, when you began this, you were a technology writer. You were the founder of one of the biggest tech blogs in the world, Boing Boing. It's kind of probably safe to say that the main thing you did with your hands was type on a keyboard. What happened when you began trying to make things?
I definitely did make a lot of mistakes. Raising chickens was a lot of fun, but then we moved from one house to another house where there were a lot of coyotes living there, and the coyotes started picking the chickens off one by one. Everything I tried to do to save the chickens seemed to result in a mistake. And so I talked about that kind of thing quite a bit. But, you know, I also had quite a few successes also because I just kept on going. And, you know, one of the things I discovered that I really like to do is to make musical instruments on my own, especially things like cigar box guitars and ukuleles and things like that. And, you know, I make mistakes when I make those things, but I'm really happy with the way that they sound, and they're really great to give as gifts. My daughter started to learn how to play a cigar box guitar, and it's turned out to be like a really fun part of my life that I'm really glad that I decided to give it a try.
What made you want to make cigar box guitars and handmade musical instruments?
I somehow had stumbled across a website called cigarboxnation.com. And it's a website online that has basically resources and a community space for homemade stringed instrument enthusiasts. And they post the photos of the cigar box guitars and violins and basses that they make. They post videos of them playing. They post plans and instructions. They talk about tips, you know, how to electrify the instrument. And when I saw the videos and saw how good they actually sounded, you know, for $20 to put together something out of a cigar box and a piece of wood and, you know, a few guitar strings, and it actually sounds really cool. It turns out that it's not that difficult to build something that sounds really good.
So what's the first one you built?
Well, the first one I built had the tuning of a hammer dulcimer, and it was just a little piece of wood that I used from a kitchen table that we had basically thrown onto our scrap pile because it broke. My kids actually had taken the table and turned it into a little clubhouse, but I saw that piece of wood, the one that I wanted on the clubhouse, and I pried it off, much to their chagrin, and made this little hammer dulcimer, and I used matchsticks for the frets. I put a little electric pickup on it. You can take a little buzzer, like a little audible buzzer that Radio Shack sells, and crack open the plastic housing, and it actually makes a good acoustic pickup, and I added that to it. And, you know, it took me a long afternoon to build it on a weekend. I thought, you know, this sounds so much better than I thought it would. And so then I just continued to make them. And I think I'm working on my 10th instrument right now.
You actually sent us a recording of you playing, I guess, one of your instruments. Here, we'll play a little bit and then you tell us what we just heard.
That was just, you know, kind of a variation on the 12-bar blues. They turn out to be really good instruments to improvise. And that kind of sliding sound you heard is a little bottleneck slider that I made. It wasn't really a bottleneck. It was a piece of bamboo that I cut from a bamboo plant growing in my yard. And it fits nicely on my ring finger and works as a slider. So it has that kind of slide guitar sound to it.
How has it changed your life to go from being primarily a consumer and a writer and editor about technology to being somebody who also makes things?
You know, there are a couple of things. One is that it's turned out to be a lot of fun for me to do something with my kids because they're always curious when, you know, they see me working on something or using a new tool. They want to try it out. They like to get involved with the projects and make things. They love to help process the honey. They basically take over when I bring the honeycomb into the house. They want to, you know, crush the honeycomb and strain it and put it into the little jars and things like that. So just the kind of family fun aspect of it. The other thing I think that's had a big effect on me is that I have become more observant of everyday life. You know, now that I make my own yogurt and sauerkraut and kombucha, grow my own vegetables, I pay more attention when I taste them. I pay more attention to the meals that I prepare that use those ingredients. And I become more observant of how other food tastes and how other, you know, yogurt and honey tastes, comparing it to my own. There's just a lot of benefits from it, and they just keep coming.
Mark Frauenfelder is the author of Make, Searching for Meaning in a Throwaway World, and Strange Chimps spoke with him. To find out more about the books and music you've heard in this hour, stop by our website. It's ttbook.org. You can become a Facebook fan of To the Best of Our Knowledge there, too. Just follow the link. Coming up next, found film makes waves in the work of avant-garde filmmaker Bruce Conner. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Before upcycling had a name, San Francisco-based beatnik filmmaker Bruce Conner was doing it to make movies back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Conner's been credited as the father of the music video, and his style of montage has influenced the filmmakers of Hollywood and beyond. Film critic David Sterrett is a big admirer of Bruce Conner's work. Sterrett's the chairman of the National Council of Film Critics and the author of The Honeymooners. He says, like the upcyclers of today, Bruce Conner turned to found materials for many of his movies. In this case, he used found film.
According to him, he couldn't afford a movie camera. But what he could afford to do was to go out and buy copies of 16-millimeter movies that had been made for educational purposes, for classroom purposes, instructional films, training films.
It's not all instructional, though. I mean, there are girly movies and, you know, some pretty racy stuff, as well as old newsreels and B-movies.
Oh, I did not mean to imply that there was not a lot of a lot of cheesecake in there, too. Absolutely, no. The idea is that he would buy this old stuff and just sort of comb through it. And then he got the idea of making a movie, which he gave the brilliant title to. It's called A Movie, that would kind of extend his collage aesthetic. This is me speaking. I'm not sure he would have put it just that way. But extend his collage aesthetic. You know, collage is putting one thing next to another. And in film, you have montage, which is putting one thing after another. And just take a whole bunch of that footage that he had been collecting and choose the bits that looked likely to him and start piecing them together and then just experimenting and tweaking and fiddling around for a really long time until he had what he wanted.
Well, we should describe this movie. I mean, called A Movie, which was his first film. It came out in 1958. It's filled with images of war, with naked women, and then it goes on from there. Tell us what it looks like.
Yeah, well, the way it starts out, first of all, it gives the title A Movie, and it gives the artist by Bruce Conner, and then it sort of gives those again, and then it gives those again for a really long time. And that's the whole first part of the film, basically, is the title of the film and his name, which is a joke and also kind of a statement about some of his unease at being an artist in the public sphere. But we also are starting to see footage, and after a while, the motion picture footage takes over, and we start to have chases. And we have cowboys chasing Indians and cops chasing robbers, and one chase after another. And it's sort of like a scene that he had admired in one of the Marx Brothers movies, Duck Soup, I think it was, where all these different kinds of things all sort of join in this impossible cockamamie chase.
And we should point out, there's no dialogue. It's just set to music.
Yeah. It's set to The Pines of Rome, a painfully familiar piece of light classical music by Ottorino Respighi. Everybody's heard it on the radio about a jillion times, so it's quite familiar. And that is the entire soundtrack. What's interesting, I think, and the most brilliant part of the movie is when we get to the last portion, when he's put together all kinds of material, again, from all kinds of movies, but now it's really dark and it's very sad, and there are suffering people and there are dead animals. And there are just things that it's not awfully pleasant to look at. And the music, interestingly, gets more and more triumphant. And then we start seeing more and more examples of modern mechanisms of destruction. And you realize that a whole subtext of this movie, which now comes to the fore, has been the idea of humanity's extraordinary gift for figuring out ways to damage and destroy itself.
It's certainly one of the most powerful films of Bruce Conner was his film about the assassination of John F. Kennedy in Dallas. And,
yeah.
And here you have actual words. In fact, quite a fascinating audio track.
Yeah, it really is. It's been written about a lot. It took him about 4 years to make, and it's a little under 15 minutes long. Report is really in a couple of different sections, and one of the sections really deals very much with the way in which the assassination, through the Zapruder film footage that was made on the spot, and also through the media, let's say reportage of and exploitation of that material, how it all became part of a media buzz where the personal chill and even horror that he had felt had just been lost because we were always being bombarded with this stuff over and over again until it began to lose its meaning.
It appears as though something has happened in the motorcade route. Something, I repeat, has happened in the motorcade route. There's numerous people running up the hill alongside Elm Street. there by the Simmons Freeway.
And he bombards us with, at one point, a flashing screen. I mean, we're hearing this audio footage. I mean, it sounds like newsreel footage, and the thing is just flashing at us, and then it goes dark, and then it comes back, and yes, he's obviously playing with how we watch a film, how we take in the news.
Absolutely. And since obviously we're long into the age of television, when we get into the 1960s, the second part of it starts to intercut commercials and things like that. I believe the last word that we hear, or maybe we see it on the screen, is sell.
And he's, I mean, it's sort of a devastating commentary. I mean, he's suggesting that we've turned the assassination of the president into a commodity, into something to sell.
I would go farther than that. I would say he's proved that it's been turned into a commodity, into something to sell, and something that is used to sell other things. At one point, we hear what appears to be a radio announcer going on at great length describing the route that the motorcade will take.
Right.
And viewed from a post-JFK assassination perspective, and especially from a post-9/11 perspective, right, even more post-9/11, it's absolutely chilling. We're getting practically a roadmap. We're getting, you know, a GPS before they existed, telling us exactly where he'll be at every moment, and pointing out that his security people are a little unhappy because he really does like to just stop and get out and shake hands. It's as if the culture was somehow willing this tragedy to happen.
Through the downtown area on Harwood to Maine, west on Maine to Houston, through the Triple Underpass to Stemmons Freeway, then on to the trademark.
Now, on the other end of the spectrum, as we've mentioned, Bruce Conner is sometimes credited with inventing the music video, and apparently he said, don't blame me. what movies should we point to that show sort of the art of the music video?
Arguably, my favorite Bruce Conner movie is one with a very politically incorrect title called Mongoloid, a hit song by the group Devo, which I happen to admire quite a lot. And this film, three and a half minutes long from 1978, is just the Devo song with just pure Bruce Conner visual montage accompanying it with everything from what appear to be very badly done kind of classroom films. At one point, we have a close-up of a very worried-looking 1940s-type man, and words appear on the screen. What can be done about Larry's personal problems? We don't know who Larry is. We don't know what his personal problems are, but it's a marvelous moment. Again, as so often in Conner, hilarious and kind of terrifying at the same time. But I have to mention one more cut, which is one of my favorites in all of cinema, which shows a man, a rather sort of burly-looking face that he has, and he appears to be wearing a suit and tie, and he's got something in his mouth, and you can't quite tell what it is. And then we cut to the next shot, and it would be fascinating to know when in the world and where in the world this was filmed, we see that the man is pulling a school bus on a rope and holding this thing in his teeth. He's pulling a school bus with his teeth. So, okay. And then we move on from that to the next part of the film. So, again, these things that he finds, which sometimes I think that's one of the funniest movies I've ever seen, and other times I think it's one of the scariest.
David Sterrett is the chair of the National Society of Film Critics and former longtime critic for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke with Steve Paulson about the films of Bruce Conner. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website. It's ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1121B, Upcycling. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Leanne Ziegler and Veronica Rickert, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.